Don't you just love that song, Holy, Holy, Holy? What a majestic tribute to our great God whom we worship. And good morning again to each of you at Terra Shores, and good morning to those of you at River Shores this morning. I believe you just finished singing Holy, Holy, Holy also there this morning. It reminds us that God is sovereign above all, and in a very real sense, separated from us, and we would have no hope because of our sinfulness of being close to Him, except that He has provided a means of salvation for us. This morning, we are moving out of the book of John. We'll come back to the book of John, Lord willing, again in the fall. But during these summer months, apart from some special days, we will spend some time looking at the Old Testament book of Esther. If you've ever wondered, ever had the question go through your mind, am I doing the right things in life? Am I making the right decisions? Should have I taken a different path in life? Should have I made some other career choices or gone a different direction? Maybe you've asked yourself the question, why has God put me in this specific place or this specific time? If you've ever wondered those questions, I want to put your heart at ease this morning to understand that God is sovereign and nothing escapes His notice, and He accomplishes all things for His purpose. And one of the key lessons of this book of Esther is that God in His sovereignty puts us when He wants us and where He wants us in history. And this book, if you haven't found it already, is located between the Old Testament book of Nehemiah, just before the book of Job. We had gone through some time ago the book of Ezra. And the time frame of the book of Esther is actually between chapters 6 and 7 in the book of Ezra. It is taking place in the country or the nation, the kingdom of Persia. It's uncertain who wrote the book of Esther. It's possible that Esther's cousin Mordecai wrote it, but it's also possible that he didn't. Apparently, someone who was close to the situation that we will study as we go through this book in the kingdom of Persia wrote about Esther's story. It's an amazing story. One of the unique things about this book of Esther is that the book of Esther is the only book in our Bible that never mentions the name of God. Isn't that interesting? The book of Esther never mentions the name of God. But as commentator Matthew Henry says, if the name of God is not here, His finger is here. Because as clearly as any book in the Bible, the book of Esther shows that there is a sovereign God who orchestrates all things to accomplish His will in this world. Now we might wonder, why isn't the name of God in this book? Bible teacher Henrietta Mears a number of years ago said, we must remember that Esther, probably being written in Persia, needed to go through Persian censors who would have censored this book. And why would they put the name of the Jewish God or allow that name to be put in there? Rather, it comes to us as a record of events that occurred and has the marks of historicity of major events in a major world power that were clearly being orchestrated by God. This book is not just for the Persians. It has a huge impact upon Jews. In fact, Jews to this day celebrate the book of Esther and the events that came out of the book of Esther in the feast of Purim, or Purim, if you want to pronounce it as North Americans here may pronounce it. It reminds us that God has a special place for the Jews, and He has used them in history, and he has preserved them through history as no other people. This book shows us, as I mentioned, the sovereignty of God, and it is a book that has five major characters, the first of whom we're going to look at briefly this morning. It was the king of Persia, a guy by the name of Xerxes. And this morning, as we look at these first 10 or 11 verses, I want to invite you to have a Bible open with me. We're going to note three specific areas of Xerxes' life where he was characterized by excess. He was a man of excess. And he had excess in various areas. The first area was that of his power. And we read these words as the book begins. Verse 1, this is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The book begins with not once upon a time, but with a common formula that is used to begin a number of historical books in the Old Testament. This is what happened, or sometimes it's translated, now it came to pass, or and it was. And it introduces this history of what occurred. And it's about this guy, Xerxes. You see his name there. Now, maybe, depending on the version you're using of Bible, you might have the name Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus was the Hebrew name, but in Greek, translated Xerxes. This guy was Xerxes the First. And he had a colorful past. His grandfather was Cyrus, the Persian king, who years before, some close to 50 years before, had told the Jewish people who were captive in Persia, you may go back to Jerusalem. And 50,000 went back. And we have that recorded for us in the book of Ezra, and we read about that some time ago. It was under his grandfather that happened. Under his father, whose name was Darius, the temple was rebuilt. And we talked about that some time ago as we studied the book of Ezra and then Haggai, Zechariah, the temple built in Jerusalem. But now comes Xerxes on the scene here. And Xerxes was mentioned one other place. He's mentioned in the book of Ezra chapter 4 in the context of saying that during his reign as king of Persia, there were a number of people who opposed the Jews and their rebuilding of the temple there in the land of Judah in Jerusalem. So he was a man with a colorful background and lots of lineage ahead of him who were great kings. We look at his kingdom, we go on and read here in the rest of verse 1, this is the Xerxes the First, who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. Now, I would like to take a look with you this morning at a map, and I think we have a map there that we can put up. Hopefully we have a map of Persia that we can put up there. Persia was a massive empire, and when it mentions, that's not the map. You can work on getting the map up there. We've got quite a few pictures, so the map of Persia, if we find that here, will show you that it stretched all the way from modern-day Pakistan, actually southern Pakistan, all the way. Nope. Maybe it's there. Maybe we don't have it in there. Maybe we didn't get it in there. The map of Persia is a map that stretches all the way from modern-day Pakistan, all the way through the Mideast, through Iran and Iraq, where the headquarters of it was, down through the Mideast, down through Palestine, all the way down to Egypt, and down south of Egypt, actually what is today northern Sudan. So it was a massive world empire. The nation of Persia was spoken of by the prophet Daniel the century before this. Maybe you remember King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon had a vision of a great statue. The head was gold, the head and shoulders are gold, and the chest and arms were silver. And gold represented Babylon, but the next world power that came on the scene was Persia, represented by the silver. Daniel had a vision of four beasts, and Persia was represented by a bear. The reason is because the Persian Empire was known for its power. It was a nation that had a military that was mammoth. In fact, some think that these events that we read about here in Esther took place just before King Xerxes led the Persian armies against Greece. In fact, historians tell us that the Persian armies numbered as many as 2.5 million people. Now, some think that's an exaggeration, but they still far outnumbered the Greeks. So this kingdom was a massive kingdom. And in verse 1 there, we read that he ruled over 120 provinces. The kingdom or the nation, the power of Persia, was developed into 20 different states, further subdivided into 127 different provinces, stretching all the way from Pakistan down to what would be northern Sudan today. Maybe we just didn't find that. I'm sorry if we don't have that map in there. The picture that we have here, though, of Persia is one of a massive power. Now, you'll notice that in this verse it mentions at that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. Now, this citadel here refers to an acropolis, a high mountain. Now, I saw that picture up here a bit earlier. It was a picture of a elevated ground in the middle of the city here, and this would be that area. Archaeologists have gone to study that area. This sat 120 feet above the plain that was around the rest of the region there, and this citadel was his palace region. That was his headquarters. It was one of four different cities that were the major headquarters, but Susa was the winter spot. The reason is because the city of Susa, which is in modern-day Iran, about 150 miles north of the Persian Gulf, was hot during the summer months. In fact, one of the writers, one of the Greek writers, said about Persia that it was so hot, lizards and snakes burned to death if they crossed the street at noon. And if you put cold water out, it was immediately ready and warm enough to take a bath in. It was so hot in that region. But this was the winter palace of Xerxes, and he reigned from that area of the citadel of Susa. Now, as we look at this situation here, just let me tell you what archaeology has told us a little bit about Xerxes. Inscriptions have been found that tell us Xerxes referred to himself as the great king, the king of kings, the king of the lands occupied by many races, the king of this great world. What does that tell you about Xerxes? Xerxes was a powerful man and he knew it. Xerxes reigned over a massive portion of the known world at that time. And the first two verses that we read here in our Bibles set the tone for us of what occurs in this book. And the Jews were captives of Xerxes there in Persia. Now his grandfather, Cyrus, had let many go back, but many of the Jews that had been taken into captivity by the Babylonians, who were later defeated by the Persians, many of those had settled down there in Babylon and Persia, that region, and they didn't want to move back to Jerusalem. And they were under the reign of Xerxes. Now in verse 3, we read about a banquet that took place. In the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all of his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes, the nobles of the princes were present. This massive banquet for all of his nobles and officials, notice, included military leaders and officials of the government. The third year would have been 483 BC. So we're talking about events that actually occurred in time and space. This banquet theme we see throughout the book of Esther. There was a banquet at the beginning of the book. There's the banquet and Feast of Purim at the end of the book. And there was a banquet in the middle of the book. There are always banquets. And these banquets were no light things. It was a time to celebrate and him to display his right to rule. In fact, an ancient Greek historian by the name of Herodotus tells us that this banquet may have occurred at this time because Xerxes wanted to impress everyone before he took his armies into battle. He wanted to show his right to rule over the world. And the Greeks still lay outside of his rule. And so he was getting ready to attack them and had this banquet and had all of his military might come together. Maybe some of you saw a few weeks ago, North Korea had a military parade. And it was on some of the news stations showing them parading, just like the Soviet Union used to do, parading their missiles and parading their men walking in the goose step, you know, through the streets there. And then shortly after that parade was done, there was a blurb that came out that said actually some of those missiles may have been fakes that were put through the parade there. But Xerxes was wanting to display his power, his right to rule the world. And he calls this banquet together and people come from all over to take part in this. In fact, one of the ancient writers said that these Persian banquets may have had as many as 15,000 people there. Can you imagine? 15,000 people at this banquet. And in this third year of his reign, 483 BC, he gave this banquet for everyone. And people from all the various provinces were present there. Xerxes was a powerful king, and he displayed his power. It's important for us to understand this because we have the backdrop of the book of Esther understanding that God is sovereign. But Xerxes didn't understand that. Xerxes thought that he was sovereign, that he was king of this world, king of kings, as he called himself. President Theodore Roosevelt was known for a statement that his pet proverb, speak softly and carry a big stick. Some of you remember that statement, speak softly and carry a big stick. By that he meant that the U.S. needed to have a strong military, and in doing that it could work its will among the nations of the world. But in 1901, Roosevelt elaborated on his philosophy, and this is what he said. He said, if a man continually blusters about his strength, a big stick will not save him from trouble. But on the other hand, neither will speaking softly do anything if behind the softness there is no strength or no power. And Xerxes was a man who had power militarily, but he let everybody know it. And he wanted to display and he wanted to intimidate by doing that. And as we look at this character of Xerxes, I want us to think for a moment how we handle authority in our lives. Because in a very real sense, every one of us have a certain amount of power. We know our power is limited, but if you are a parent, you are in a position of authority. If you are a teacher, you are in a position of authority. If you are a CEO, you are in a position of authority. If you are an upperclassman in high school, you are in a position of authority. Every one of us have authority in certain areas. How do we handle that authority? Do we want to let everybody know that we're in charge, we're in authority? That was Xerxes. Or do we speak softly, meekness, but there's authority behind that? How do we handle responsibility? Do we use it to glorify us? That's how Xerxes used his authority, to glorify himself. How do you use your authority? How do I use my authority? It's a good question to ask us as we begin this book of Esther, because what we're going to see is that ultimately God is always in charge. And with any authority that we've been entrusted, it is wise for us to realize that we only have any authority from him who has all authority. Xerxes was a man of power, excess power. He knew it, but eventually it would be his downfall. Second important excess for Xerxes was his property. We read in verse 4 these words. For a full 180 days he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. For a full 100, that's almost a half a year. 180 days he displayed his vast wealth of his kingdom and the glory of his majesty. He put it on display, his extravagance, because the view was that the more you can convince people how wealthy you are, the more you convince them of your right to rule over them. So for half a year, he invited people in to see everything that he had. His unlimited resources would show his power, and Xerxes had inherited most of this from his father, but he displayed it for a great length of time. Now, some have said, boy, it couldn't have been that he had this display going on and everybody came to it for 180 days. Officials couldn't be gone from their posts for 6 months. And the thought is that they may have rotated in and out, but that everybody had to come and see Xerxes' display of wealth. Verse 5, we read, when these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people, from the least to the greatest, who were in the citadel of Susa. He ended that 180 days with a 7-day banquet. And in this banquet, he would display the resources that he had to supply for everyone. And notice, in the citadel there, he had everybody that was part of that, servants on up to the top chiefs there in the citadel, were part of this banquet. And the description here of this is interesting. Verse 6. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. I think we have some pictures of Susa, some archaeological pictures of what this massive citadel area looked like. And we just will flash through some of these different pictures, because these pictures are all part of this throne room, and the various courts had a number of courts. It covered acres, this raised area in the city of Susa. And they know exactly where this place was, where it took place. In fact, this was the very place, the citadel, this palace in Susa, where Nehemiah, in Nehemiah chapter 1, was the cupbearer for the king that we read about. And we can go and you can look at this place, except it's in Iran. It might be a little difficult to get at. But French excavators in the late 1800s found this and dug through this area, and in their excavation displayed the colored tiles and the variety of things that went on. As you look at verse 6, the hangings, probably curtains of white and blue, you look at the colors of the purple, it was specifically geared to show royalty, to show power and strength. Now he's displaying his wealth. In fact, you'll notice that he mentions couches of silver and gold. It was from Persia that we have this tradition of reclining at the table. You've heard that term from the New Testament. Jesus and his disciples reclined. Well, that idea came from Persia on these couches on which they reclined at table. And it hit Israel by the time of the ancient prophet Amos. But by the time we get to the New Testament, it was common practice there, reclining at table. And that tradition comes from Persia. The picture here of this palace with all of these various courtyards and gardens, it's a picture of a beautiful park. Gorgeous. In fact, the English word that we have, paradise, is a Persian word. It's a Persian word that means park. So the description here in Esther chapter 1, verses 5 and 6, is meant to picture a beautiful area, a park area. Added to that, these colorful curtains and hangings with regal and royal colors. Along with that, you have this display of gold and silver, these couches. You have the costly stones, the inlaid mosaics of stone. It is fascinating. Now, I've never been to Susa, but a few years back when we were in Israel, in the Holy Land, you can see some of the Roman buildings that were built before Christ. And especially in the city of Caesarea along the coast there, named after Caesar, you can see mosaic floors, tiled floors that are still left. The buildings are gone, but these mosaic floors with these tiny stones inlaid intricately, well, that's the picture of what you've got going on here. He is displaying his vast wealth. And in the midst of this, he is proving how he is worthy to provide whatever is needed. Because he's wealthy. Joe Stoll was a pastor or the president of Moody Bible Institute for a number of years when Ryan and Jody were there. And some of you have heard Joe Stoll speak at Promise Keepers events or whatever. But Joe Stoll tells the story that several years ago when they were still living in Chicago, at that time they decided to move from in the city to the western suburbs to be near their grandkids. And he said, we got this little piece of land, and he said, we built what we thought was our dream house. Now, he said it wasn't over the top by any means, but it was nice. And he said we liked how it looked from the curb. We liked how it lived on the inside. It was far more than we deserve. But we really liked our house. He said, however, I hate to admit this, about 6 months after we built our house, he said, I was driving through this beautiful neighborhood, another neighborhood, and I saw another house that caught my attention. He said the colors, the architecture, the lot, the location all had a big wow factor for me. And my first thought was, boy, do I wish I had that house. And then he said, I wondered, what's wrong with us? Have you ever wondered what's wrong with us? He said, and I realized as I thought about it, it was the Eve factor in our lives. We're born with it. It's deeply embedded in our DNA. It's one more proof of our sinfulness. Just as Eve's heart was drawn away from God in Genesis chapter 3, she had all that she needed. But what was it that seduced her into the material world, into Satan's clutches? What was it? She wanted more than what she had. What she had, although awesome and satisfying, wasn't enough for her. In fact, God wasn't enough. And she was willing to do anything, even if it meant turning her back on God. And that, he said, is at the core of greed, a lack of contentment. I'm sure Xerxes' display made people go, if I had a tenth of that, if I had a hundredth of that. Now let me ask you a question here. When it comes to property, stuff, how does it affect you? Is it the type of thing like with Xerxes that you like to show off your stuff because it makes you feel like you've made it? Is it the type of thing where you feel you haven't made it and so you're striving with all your might to get all you can of the stuff of this world? Does the stuff of your life give you your identity? Does it determine who you are? Does it give you your security? Let me ask you this. Suppose the bottom fell out of our economy and suddenly you lost all your stuff. Interesting question, isn't it? What if suddenly all of our stocks were worth nothing? What if suddenly everything was back on the barter system again? How would that affect our identity of who we are? It's worthwhile thinking about because it could happen. How does stuff affect us? And when we have been blessed with stuff, how do we use that stuff? Our property is only entrusted to us by God, and it only finds its fulfillment in its being used to serve Him. Not only in the book of Job, but also in the book of Ecclesiastes, God reminds us that we brought nothing into this world and we're not taking a thing out. Therefore, the stuff of life is not really the stuff of life. Xerxes thought it was, and he displayed it. And notice in verse 7, he goes on there, we go on and read about Xerxes. Wine was served in goblets of gold. Each one was different from the other. And the royal wine was abundant in keeping with the king's liberality. Xerxes provided an open bar. You may drink what you want. Now, according to some of the ancient historians here, they say that that there was a law that you had to drink when the king drank. But here he was giving liberality. It was abundant. You could drink according to the king's hand whatever you wanted. We accumulate stuff, and he even had gold goblets for drinking out of. We go on in verse 8, and we read this theme continue here. We see his pride coming out. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. It gives us a hint of Xerxes' lack of moral character. He was willing to trust every man to drink whatever he wanted to. You didn't have to drink much, but if you wanted to drink excess, feel free to do that. Many drank in excess. In fact, we're going to see that as we go on here. But there's a brief change here now in verse 9, and a new character comes in, Queen Vashti. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of Xerxes. Now, we aren't told a lot about Vashti. It's a Persian word meaning beautiful woman. So she was obviously very pleasing to look at. And Queen Vashti, at the same time Xerxes had this going on for all the men, had a banquet for the women. Why didn't she join? In fact, it was common to have co-ed banquets. They had banquets for men and women together. But this particular occasion, she had a banquet just for the women. We're not told why. It may have been because of the number of people here. Maybe she needed to divide it up because there were too many people. It may have been because Xerxes knew that this banquet that he was throwing was going to be a bit wild and it might offend the sensibilities of the women. So Vashti had her own banquet. We're not told why, but she had her own banquet. But in verse 10, notice what takes place at the men's banquet. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded seven eunuchs who served him, Mahuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and the nobles, for she was lovely to look at. Now, notice the setting for this. The men are all there, drinking all that they want, and we read that Xerxes was in high spirits from the wine. Actually, the words that are used there, literally it says, the heart of the king was good with wine. It's the same phrase that is used to describe foolish man Nabal in 1 Samuel 25, who was drunk. Same word, same phrase used to describe Amnon, the brother of Absalom, whom Absalom killed when Amnon had gotten drunk. So Xerxes was drunk. He had drank too much. That was the setting there. He was in high spirits. And it's at that point that he makes this statement to bring before him Queen Vashti wearing her royal crown. I want to mention something about this, and I hardly ever have mentioned this here at Terra Shores. The danger of drunkenness. We have this example of Xerxes here, but it is rampant in our culture. In fact, I was reading this week, the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention released a report here in 2012 that outlined the alarming amount of binge drinking in America here. That out of a survey of 458,000 adults reported the following statistics out of this. 17.1% of the number of U.S. adults who binge drink at least four times a month. And it goes on and talks about of those earning $75,000 a year or more, 20.2% of our population binge drinks. Now, binge drinking, what they're talking about when they say binge drinking is they're talking about for men where you have five drinks or more in a very short period of time. For women, four drinks or more in a very short period of time. So they're talking about inebriation. The cost of binge drinking was estimated in this report of $223.5 billion. The cost, estimated cost annually of America's drinking problem, including medical expenses, loss of productivity, that sort of thing. The number of Americans who die each year from drinking-related causes, which includes drunk driving and suicide, 80,000. The cost of this is amazing. One of these researchers for the study commented, "We're talking about a risk behavior that's quite widespread in the population and where people have the impression it's not such a bad thing to do." But we're going to see in this book of Esther that Ahasuerus, Xerxes' drinking, changed the course of world history, changed the course of his empire. And it is important for us to understand this came in the section where he is displaying his pride. Proverbs 31 says, "Listen, my son, listen, son of my womb. It is not for kings to drink wine, nor for rulers to crave beer, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and deprive the oppressed of their rights." And then Xerxes makes this demand of Vashti, of this beautiful queen. First of all, he sends these seven eunuchs to go get her. Why didn't he go get her himself? He probably couldn't. He probably could hardly walk correctly. And he knew that he wouldn't be able to bring her, so he sends these guys to go get her. And his command, you'd think she would take it as an honor. "You're so beautiful. Come wearing your crown and appear before my guests." The only problem is that many rabbinic interpreters think that what he was actually saying here is, "Come wearing your crown and nothing else." You see, drinking causes a loss of judgment. And Xerxes wasn't the first, and he won't be the last husband to offend his wife because of excessive drinking. Or maybe it goes the other way, spouse to spouse. It can become a great problem, and it became a major division here. And we won't this week have a chance, we'll pick this up next week and look at Vashti's response to this. But the question I want to ask here as we look at this morning, is alcohol a problem for you or for your relationships? Has it ever gotten you in trouble or caused you to say things or do things that would have been better unsaid or undone? And those who are closest to you, Vashti with Xerxes, what would they say about you? Are you sensitive? Are you kind? Are you at home what you are in public? You know, we look at Xerxes this morning and what we see is a man of excess. Excess power, excess property, excess pride. And God allowed him to live in his excess, and God used Xerxes to fulfill his will, but in the midst of it, we certainly do not see a king who is humbled before God. There's a hugely popular board game that some of you may have played, the Game of Life, through the years. You know, the first prototype of that game came out actually in 1798 before Milton Bradley was born. It was a board game from England called The New Game of Human Life. And the game acquired virtues as you sped through the game while vices would slow you down. And parents were encouraged to play this game with their kids. Life was a voyage that begins at birth and ends at death. And God was at the helm and fate is cruel and there is a reward that lies beyond the grave. Then in 1860, Milton Bradley invented the simple board game and he called it the checkered game of life. Now, this game, they had a good path you could follow that included honesty and bravery, and it had a difficult path that you could follow that included idleness and disgrace. Industry and perseverance led to wealth and success, and Bradley described it as a highly moral game. It encourages children to lead exemplary lives and entertain both old and young with a spirit of friendly competition. Now, that game was revised and modified, and in 1960, the Milton Bradley Company released a commemorative edition, and they called it simply the Game of Life. That's the game that most of us grew up with. That's the game that I grew up playing. Some of you grew up playing the Game of Life. And if you remember and you played that Game of Life, this game sold 35 million copies, you remember that virtues and vices were non-existent. The winner of the game was the one who got the most money at the life's day of reckoning. Ended up at Millionaire Acres. You remember that? Millionaire Acres instead of in the poorhouse. That was the game of life and that was the goal of life. In the 1990s, Milton Bradley Company designers tried to make it a game less about money, so they emphasized good deeds, life-saving, like saving endangered species or solving a pollution problem. The only problem is the reward for doing those good deeds was cash, money. So in 2011, there's a new version that came out. Players can attend school, they can travel, they can start a family, do whatever they want. And if they earn enough points, they can reward themselves with a sports car. There's no end or last square to the game. You can stop whenever you want. There's no ending point. And the box says this, 1,000 ways to live your life. You choose. As far as values in this new game of life, they're up for grabs. You get as many points for scuba diving as you get for donating a kidney. And the website description says this, do whatever it takes to retire in style with the most wealth at the end of the game. That's what we're teaching. That's what we're teaching. Well, the truth of the matter is that Xerxes needed to learn his excess was from God and was to be used to honor God. And he would learn the hard way. I like what Warren Wiersbe says about this. People in authority need to remember that all authority comes from God and he alone is in complete control. Pharaoh had to learn that lesson in Egypt. Nebuchadnezzar had to learn it in Babylon. Belshazzar learned it in Babylon. Sennacherib learned it at the gates of Jerusalem. And Herod Agrippa learned it as he died from being eaten by worms. Every man or woman in a place of authority needs to learn that they are not really the authority. They are second in authority to Jesus Christ, who is the King of Kings. So as we look at Xerxes this morning, this important king in world history, who lost the battle to the Greeks, changed the course of world history, this king could have taken a dose of what John wrote in 1 John chapter 2. Do not love the world or the things of the world. For if anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is of the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, are not of the Father, but of the world. For the world and its lusts pass away, but he that doeth the will of God abideth forever. Let's pray together. Lord, this morning as we take communion together, we remember the great price paid for our salvation. Forgive us, O God, for our sins, for our worldliness, for the lust of our flesh, the lust of our eyes, and the pride of life that we so easily cling to. Lord, remove it, we pray, and forgive us. Thank you for the gift of salvation that we do not deserve, but Lord, for which, in gratitude, we gladly submit ourselves to you. And we remember you now as we take together these elements in the name of Jesus. Amen. With those who are going to assist with the Lord's